This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
It's a personal pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, Dr. Megumi Okumura, who is Professor of Pediatrics, Internal Medicine, and Health Policy. She is Director of the UCSF Resident Research Training Program, Director of the Pediatric Clinical Translational Sciences Pathway, and Medical Director of the UCSF Health Pediatric to Adult Transitions. She provides direct care to children and youth in UCSF's Pediatric Acute Care Clinic, and also provides primary care to adults with medical complexity whose medical conditions started during childhood in UCSF's General Internal Medicine Clinic. Please welcome Dr. Okumura.
Thank you so much for that introduction, John. It's such a pleasure and an honor to be here today to talk about a topic area that I'm very passionate about, both clinically and in research. So just for full disclosure, despite the fact of, you know, giving care and living in the San Francisco Bay Area, sadly, I have no monetary disclosures to report. I am a general internist and a pediatrician and a health services researcher. And again, as John had mentioned, my primary care practice focuses on patients with childhood onset chronic conditions in the general medicine clinic. And I'm the newly appointed medical director for pediatric to adult healthcare transitions for UCSF Health. Don't throw tomatoes yet. I've been at my job for 3 months, but it is an area which the health system found is a really important area that needs focus, as many of you in the room already know. And again, my research actually focuses on improving quality of care delivery during the transition from pediatric to adult focused services, and especially for community-based supports as well as within health systems. So the goals that I wanted to go over today was to differentiate transition, which is a process, and transfer, which is the event, from pediatric adult focused healthcare for persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And to learn what you can do to help in the transition process, whether you are a patient, a caregiver, a community-based organization, or within the healthcare system. This applies to everybody. And learn about the tools and resources that are available to you to help in this process. Because the key throughout is that doing nothing is terrible. But, you know, there is a whole spectrum of things that we can do to help in this process. So I first wanted to ground us on the concept of transition versus transfer. I think when we think about transition, the vast majority really focus on that transfer event, and a picture in people's minds often is that, you know, that cartoon that you see in front of you. You are ready, you know, you are aging out, or your patient is aging out. You don't know where they're going to go. You just kind of stick them in the canna and you shoot them and you pray. You hope they land. Do they hit a mountain? Do they hit a tree? Do you have a parachute? We don't really know. And it leads us to a point where a lot of us are really nervous, right? But that is not transitioning. Transitioning is a purposeful, planned movement of adolescents and young adults with chronic physical and medical, and I'll add developmental and mental health conditions, from a child-centered to an adult-oriented healthcare system. It takes planning. And I think that's where many people, you know, think that, oh, we just have to plan right at the end when they hit 19, 20, 21. That is not the case. We have to start earlier. And many talks yesterday discussed this early planning and emphasizing that to prevent a lot of the panic response and a lot of the problems that we have later on. Why should we care about healthcare transitions? Well, all pediatric patients become adult patients. All of us transition and transfer at some point. It's just that some individuals have a little bit more difficulties than others. As you've heard from today and yesterday, children born with chronic diseases and disabilities that were previously fatal in childhood can now expect to live well into adulthood with good care. And we still have health disparities in terms of outcomes in the adult healthcare system for these children who really should be able to have a full, meaningful life. And many adolescents and young adults struggle with life beyond pediatric systems with subsequent poor outcomes. Now, when we think about transitions to care, most of us in healthcare focus on disease management and disease outcomes. But when we look at what parents and patients actually want, well, you know, maybe that's not the most important part. Part of it is the social engagement, attainment of educational services, vocational attainment, being able to live in the world fully, just as they did as a child and doing that as an adult. And that's a really important goal that we need to articulate when we think about our transition planning. And for persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities, many of them face additional challenges through this process. Systems that support youth with intellectual and developmental disabilities no longer have systems available to them after one reaches age of the majority. What I mean by that, many of them graduate from school-based supports and programs, but remember, these are persons who oftentimes we talk about developmental delay. It's not that they've been able to complete their educational process or the developmental process. These individuals have ongoing needs for supports to continue learning and maximizing goals, again, to maximize our ability to live in the world. And there's little alignment of developmental pediatric services within the adult healthcare space. It's not to say there's exceptions. For example, Dr. Clarissa Kripke has her Office for Developmental Medicine. There are systems available, but it's not widely available yet. And those are areas that we still need to work on. Many programs are not developmentally appropriate and do not address the continuing needs of persons with intellectual developmental disabilities. And patients oftentimes lose contact with primary care and preventive services during this period. And again, yesterday people alluded to increased morbidity and mortality. This was a study done in England showing rates of preventable death in adults with intellectual disability. This is a cohort study. It was done over a 4-year period. They followed 17,000 adults with intellectual disability and matched them to about 110,000 controls without intellectual disability. They list the crude mortality rates, which for adults with intellectual disability was 132. Compared to controls, which were only 40. Now they looked at preventable death and they defined it in two different ways. One is amenable to healthcare services, which means that if you had preventive care, you caught a disease early or an infection early, that is amenable to healthcare. Preventable are things like, well, if you stop someone from smoking, they don't get lung cancer. So that's truly a preventable thing, but amenable is actually really important because these are sensitive to our healthcare system. And as you can see when we look at persons with intellectual disabilities, those that were amenable to healthcare intervention was a death rate of 49 versus 8 in controls. This really highlighted some of the disparities that we have within healthcare systems of supporting persons with intellectual disabilities. And I would argue that part of the transitioning throughout is to prepare individuals so that we have care, given just the attrition that we have with persons with chronic diseases and intellectual disabilities. So really, we can do better, and we can ensure persons with disabilities have a better process. And we think of transition as a process with caregivers, family, providers, as well as our community-based agencies, which can overcome many local barriers of care. In my talk, I'm going to talk in generalities, but we know that many people come from differing systems and supports, and there's a lot of differing resources nationally and even across statewide to support persons. Resources change. And being prepared allows us a better way to prevent loss of care and services that are critical to maintain health and wellness of our patients. And again, no one can do this alone. It takes a collaboration across agencies, parents, caregivers, clinicians to support our needs for our patients. I just wanted to think of this again, really to emphasize this is a life course event. We are trying to reduce risks of patients for preventive care. And we have protective factors. Again, that's within our homes, our communities. The upper red lines indicate what would be an ideal state of maintaining health across the lifespan. The one in the dots say, well, if you don't have those protective factors, we don't reduce risk. We don't have our village to support us. We have suboptimal care. So again, today's talk, we're going to be talking about tools and supports. And I have a whole different talk to talk about barriers and such, and why these tools have to exist in the first place. So I kind of wanted to just summarize just general differences in adult and pediatric providers and provisions, just to kind of ground us as to why these tools are even necessary in the first place. Because there are differences in the system. When we think about pediatrics, fundamentally, what is a pediatrician? A pediatrician is someone who focuses not on just the condition, but the growth and development of a child until they grow up and they hand them over to people who take care of the adult providers. Whereas in the adult healthcare system, we talk about maintenance and optimization of the present. So again, if we think about developmental disabilities or developmental delays, this is a little bit different in a different schema that we have to think about, because adult providers think that development is done, and that's not the case. Even in the what we call a child who is completely healthy, has no conditions, we know that neurodevelopmental maturation doesn't happen until age 26. And so there's always development that's going on. In terms of philosophy, pediatrics is family-centered. And we think about, well, of course, a child can't necessarily speak for themselves early on. Maybe for the downside in pediatrics, sometimes we still focus only on the parent, not necessarily the child. But it's a role reversal for entry into the adult system, because the adult system is very patient-centered. We actually, to the exclusion of the family, I notice in some talks, people talk about, oh, well, the provider doesn't talk to me. I don't hear that. In the adult setting, usually we really focus on the patient. And again, these are areas that need guidance from families as we think about transitioning. The approach in pediatrics is very proactive. It's paternalistic. We sort of make people do what we need them to do. We basically act in ensuring that parents get their things done so that they take care of the child. Whereas adult systems are very reactive. We sort of work with the patient and it's like, well, if you don't want to do this, so be it. We'll kind of go into that in terms of non-adherence. Decision-making in pediatrics is oftentimes with the family, sometimes with the exclusion of the patient. With the adult, it's mostly in the patient, sometimes the exclusion of the parent or the caregiver, which can cause conflict at times. Insurance is entitlement. And for the adults, it's you have to qualify or there's an eligibility criteria. Non-adherence is not as well tolerated in terms of pediatrics. There's more assistance to make sure that therapies are actually maintained. In adults, we're more tolerant. Again, in a child, if someone doesn't take their insulin, I can call CPS. But by the moment you're 18 or 19, if you don't take your insulin, that's up to you if you get hospitalized. And that's not saying that's the right thing, but we treat people like adults. You have a choice. We give that, it's not as flexible in pediatrics. The culture is oftentimes prevention-oriented pediatrics. It's health-oriented, there's team approaches. In adult healthcare, oftentimes very disease-specific and specialist-oriented with maintenance of care. And then finally, when we think about pediatrics, there's a lot of expertise in rare conditions and siloed disease management. We're talking about specialized disease centers that we find in peds. That is not necessarily the case in the adult healthcare system. There's less familiarity with childhood onset chronic diseases, but a very robust chronic disease resources, but these tend to be scattered across multiple clinics. which also can be very disconcerting to families as they access adult healthcare, hoping that they want everything centralized, and then we feel like there's more of a decentralized process. So these are the things that we kind of think about in how do we prepare our youth or your patient to healthcare transitions. Oh, but Maggie, it's a lot, right? You're busy. You're taking care of your patients, your child, yourself. And that's why we have to think about gradual planning. It's the long term. And worse outcomes happen when we, you know, if we don't think about these things until it's too late. That is, you have to transfer. You're aging out. The clinic has notified you that today is your last visit, which is not necessarily a rare instance. And yet we've never discussed this. I've had many patients who've said, oh my God, you know, my pediatrician, I will follow you, you know, forever, except until their supervisor says, no, you can't, right? So sometimes it's not up to that provider to be able to see you forever. And so, you know, these are the things that we have to think about. So today, for the rest of the talk, we're going to talk about different tools, how to assist a patient's caregivers, families, and providers. And I also want to acknowledge there are numerous tools for transition out there and information about navigating the transition process. I gave some very kind of high level things and resources that lead to many other types of resources out there, but it can be overwhelming. And again, there are many other tools developed by disease societies and specialty societies. You may want to consider that, especially if there's a particular disease entity that you want to look at in terms of healthcare maintenance. For example, like Down syndrome, there are very, very clear assistance and guidelines for this when we think about transitioning. So a couple of slides yesterday also had this diagram, which is the roadmap utilizing the six core elements of transition. This was developed by GOT Transition, the Center for Healthcare Transition Improvement, which is a cooperative agreement between the Maternal Child Health Bureau and the National Alliance to Advance Adolescent Health. And it goes over kind of six stages of transitioning. And I wanted to walk you through, because regardless if you are a patient, provider, or community caregiver, it's nice to know where should we be at, you know, in terms of transitioning. So the first step is either having or discussing the transition policy. And I'm gonna go over each of these six steps in the later slides. And that usually starts around age 12. Parents should know how long they can stay in the clinic. Providers should know how long they can see a patient and what are the provisions that are gonna be there to help a family through. By age 14 to 18, we think about tracking progress. And there's variability with that in terms of practice and flexibility, along with assessing skills and managing skills so that persons can lead to as independent of a process for their own healthcare as a consumer. By age 14 to 18, we start developing the transition plan. That's what are we going to do over the next 5-6 years before we get to the ultimate point of transferring care. And then by 18-20, we start thinking about those transfer documentation. What do we need? Do we need an emergency plan, for example? And then there's usually a transfer event, and that can happen in a staggered way. There's primary care transfer, subspecialty transfer. There may be just a different model of care that you're going to be transferring to, even if you stay within the same clinic. And then transfer completion. And that may be more on the system side, but again, thinking, you know, did we successfully make it there? So the first step is a transition policy. For clinicians, this helps define your scope of practice. How do you, you know, again, everyone's gonna be different. Some people won't need much transition counseling except for the fact that, hey, you know, we're gonna keep you through college. I'll help you there. Then you're off, and that's your transition plan. That may be enough. For individuals with complex medical conditions, this may be a little bit more involved. So this is where the opportunity to discuss future, you know, the future with pediatricians, thinking about, you know, what the future will lie and what you need to get done. It gives the provider and the family an end goal if the patient is to transfer care. And if the provider is not going to transfer, that is, you know, for example, family practice, genetics oftentimes will follow for life, then you can discuss how care will change over time. How does that patient engage and have greater autonomy in their own care? The second part is transition planning and tracking and assessing. So all patients and their caregivers need to think about learning skills about their or their child's long-term health. And the general guidance when we think about adolescent care is time alone with a provider. When we look at various survey methods that have asked about these transition measures, it's been pretty abysmal. Many times, you know, very few individuals have time alone with a provider. And then also, does the youth know about their own medical conditions? Or if developmentally appropriate, having youth know how to manage their medical condition, the emergency care plans, discussion of adult goals, post-secondary education and work, and also planning how this care will change once leaving high school. This includes transitional high school for those with IDD, and then also beyond. What will happen after you go ahead and age out? So when we think about that kind of assessment, there are assessment tools. And checklists can help just guide families and providers and patients about where they are at in terms of readiness for their own self-care. And again, this is a tool that was a toolkit for those with intellectual disabilities. And what's nice is you can just say, you know, is my child able to do this? What do they need in terms of supports? And what can we expect in the future? It allows providers and service agencies to better plan for future needs and gives needed support for future living, vocation, education, and programs. IEPs can do that somewhat, but we don't really think about the trajectory post-leaving secondary education. And also just, you know, again, doesn't IEPs oftentimes don't talk about health. So again, this kind of is a starting point in thinking about what do we need to do? And, you know, I emphasize transition planning because, you know, especially for those with chronic illnesses, lots of hospitalizations, there are just so many competing demands. Especially when we think about children in high school, it's just, you know, between planning for school and programs, it's easy to put this, you know, on the side. And really, transition planning has to be a deliberate step in care and case management. Knowing what insurance plan the patient will be in will also be helpful. Many people will go under SSI, for example, their public plans. And so, you know, kind of knowing that ahead of time, are you going to stay on your parents' insurance, for example? Those are things that can also help guide in terms of planning. Also asking the general guidance of who, what, when, where, why do I go to this person? Who's going to be primary care? Who will provide the specialty services? Because PED services are often mirrored in adult services, but they have different labels. And these are what we call the parallel services, and they're not identical. So the problem, of course, is many of your pediatric providers are not consumers of chronic illness care in the adult healthcare setting. They may not know what is the mirror of their service. And so again, some of those partnerships with the AVAIL programs are actually really helpful. For one case in point is G-tube care. Pediatric GI takes care of G-tubes. In the adult system, it's interventional radiology. And we work together to provide needed services for G-tube care. Again, the when, you know, this should be help, you know, this should be discussed in the policy, but that's not always the case. What age must be transferred? And where's the patient going? Are they going to stay at home? Are they doing supported living? Are they going off to school, work? These are all things that we kind of think about for our patients with special needs. And then we talk about the transition planning tools. This is the long range plan. So this is again, another handout from the Got Transition website. It discusses, did you discuss a policy, whether readiness was assessed, the existence of a medical summary, when to start an adult model of care for those who will not be transferring out of a program, and discussion of a model of care and legal considerations. This is the shared decision-making that was discussed yesterday, limited conservatorships or guardianships, depending, if you're out of California. And the specifics about transfer, to-dos for physicians and families. And I really have to highlight the importance of primary care in the adult system. Because again, if you're a pediatrician and you don't know the system, having your adult primary care colleague can help you navigate. You know, do not let your child or patient become medically homeless. Many of the referrals require primary care referrals. If any medical emergency arises, headaches, pneumonias, these patients will have to follow up with their primary care physician. It was not necessarily for subspecialty care. And in pediatrics, pediatric subspecialties may have served as primary care providers for many of these youth. And this is fundamentally different in the adult healthcare system. Most adult subspecialties is consultative. They only order white items and services specific to their disease condition and will not perform wraparound services like refilling all medications. It's not to say that is the that is complete, but that's generally speaking. And adult primary care is also required, again, for most authorizations and equipment orders and home health supports. So we are sort of like the buck stops here in primary care for us. Finally, we go into transfer planning. This is sort of the end. All parents and patients need to be aware when the practice ceases to see patients based on age criteria. And again, this should be communicated early and not 1 year prior to discharge. All patients and caregivers need to be aware that they need, again, primary care services once leaving. And you may have to think about this more than a year ahead because, for example, in our primary care practice, we were closed for 2 years due to lack of staffing. So sometimes it can be, you know, you kind of have to think ahead. Trying to find a primary care doctor in 1 month is not necessarily a reasonable expectation. And all patients should have some sort of medical summary, whether it be vaccinations, general summaries of history, or a longer, more detailed summary for those who are medically complex. Transfer documentation is probably one of the most critical things, and I can't emphasize that enough in terms of making a successful transfer of care. It allows you to prioritize needs and help the physician get to know your child. Again, we talk about assumptions, and I don't know if you can see the document to the right. There's a big open space that says, please add special information about the strengths of the youth, and their child or that patient. Because for example, if the patient has to communicate through a communication device, the primary care physician may not know. That person may not have any clue that yes, they can comprehend, that person can comprehend everything, or no, there's a significant intellectual disability, especially if someone has to use a different device or may not have brought it. So it's here, they can understand everything. Please talk to them directly. This person loves baseball. That's a great starter. This is to know that person in front of us so that we know how to address that individual. Because we can't make assumptions necessarily. Those personal needs, the priorities and preferences, and also next steps. When I see a patient, my first visit is getting to know you. Tell me about you. Why are you here? What are your interests? And then of course, we're going to the medical management, but sometimes there's some medical acuity that has to be done. We'll take care of that. That's the easy part. It's the building that relationship that is the most important. And of note, when we did a survey of our general internal medicine practice, over 50% of our providers received no documentation of a new patient within the last 3 years for any new patient who came into the practice. And it leaves them sort of second guessing. And it's not fair to the provider, and it's also not fair to the patient because we're starting, you know, there's a lot of, you know, 21 years worth of life that we have to sort of, you know, deal with and address in that first visit. Finally, then we talk about transfer care. Again, there's communication between the pediatric provider to the adult provider in both primary care and specialty care. This ensures the receiving the summary, making sure that the provider takes the insurance and that communication. In family medicine and MedPs, the reviewing of goals and planning for change is oftentimes important, even if you're not going to go ahead and transfer the clinic. And there are different ways to transfer. We talk about simple transfer, which is last patient visit in peds, then go to adult, and that's it. There's transfer with peds follow-up. The first appointment was done with an adult provider, and then they went back to the peds provider for one or two visits. Sometimes there's meet and greets and shared care models. Every system has done it differently. I will say that I've done it for my own personal practice all four ways. And it really is about the, you know, again, when you think about your transition planning, it's sort of up to you to decide between the provider and the patient, the family, what works, you know, for you. So for take homes, all youth, regardless of medical need, need some transitional assistance. And you're not alone. Acknowledging transitioning and having early discussions will allow you to better prepare all of those transfer points in our system, whether that be insurance, school, providers, service changes. And tools, remember, are just reminders. The use is really about whatever is most comfortable for you and what's beneficial for you. It allows us to discover problems before it becomes an emergency. Be sure to ask, hey, is there anything else we need to think about? Sometimes the tools just allow you to have that conversation. Not everyone will be proactive, and we don't know what we don't know. So don't assume that someone, oh yeah, you know what? I'll talk about transition when I really need it because my doctor will deal with it or my patient will say something. No, you can't make that assumption. It needs to be a proactive process. We are all advocates. We could advocate to ensure adolescents and young adults with IDD have the right supports available to them, whether it be school, work, day programs, home supports, and talk to a lot of people, ask your friends. It's all really important. And many of them will give you good supports. I have just a couple of resources for transitioning and transfer, and local Bay Area resources, but thank you for your time and happy to field questions.
Thank you, Maggie, for the talk and for emphasizing the importance of healthcare transitions as a long-term process that begins as young as age 12 years, and that it is not the same as transfer of care, and informing us of differences between the pediatric and adult healthcare worlds, and introducing us to transition tools. So I have a number of questions, but there are already some up on the Q&A, so I will ask you those questions. And so let's start with the first one. I think this has to do more with transfer of care. How do you manage situations where there is no willing adult service willing to accept the patient due to complexity of disease? And so I guess the bigger question is, you know, how do we find adult primary care providers for our patients?
You know, it's interesting because my experience had been a little bit different, at least in our general medicine practice. When we surveyed individuals in our need assessment, I had 12 internists stand up saying, I want to take these patients. So that wasn't our issue. I will say that sometimes it's not about the patient as much as the resources that are available in the practice. So for example, general medicine, we have a DME coordinator. We have home health services. It allows us to take care of complex medical complexity much easier than some of the other practices out there. So having primary care services in areas that have that serve adults with medical complexity generally is usually useful. In terms of like being able to take a patient. Now, again, part of it is a primary care shortage too. So sometimes some of the denial is not necessarily about willingness to treat as much as capacity to take on a new patient. And that again has been really, really problematic for our patients. There's the other component of shared resources. So sometimes like the RAS clinic in genetics, they were exceedingly successful in, and this is for genetic anomalies based on a certain particular pathway, Castellano syndrome, for example, significantly medically complex. But what the genetics clinic then did, because they see people across the lifespan, was partner with adult providers saying, hey, look, I just need you to do the pap smear, but I will take care of all the other programs. So that was really useful too. So there's a lot of different models of care in which either subspecialty or primary care can support a person with medical complexity and developmental needs. Again, it kind of just depends on the specifics.
So the next question, I'm going to sort of put in my interpretation, but I think the question is about decision making once you reach the age of adulthood, and you know, oftentimes this coincides at around the same time that transfer of care happens. And my sense is that because these two things happen at the same time, but the discussions don't have to, you know, be at that time. And the sort of the importance and the need to discuss all the different transitions and transfers that occur as early as possible, so that it's not like everything is happening at the same time.
Correct. There's a lot of transitions. And it's overwhelming, right? Because, oh my God, my school service ends. Oh my God, my primary care won't see me. I mean, it's really trying to stage those as best as possible so that, that again, no one comes unaware. I think that's really, really important. And it's just not overwhelming.
Another question, given the importance of transition meetings, so these are visits, can there be a billing code for this so providers are motivated or incentivized to do this more regularly, especially for individuals with complex needs?
Yeah, it's interesting. Got Transition actually has a lot of the CPT codes that they develop with CMS. So there's a whole handout on billing structure. If you think about it, I think there's the G2212. There's a new care coordination code that you can add to your billing because you're talking to another provider. You know, for example, that is right there is a transition visit. I'm going to go ahead and talk to an adult provider and, you know, about transitioning and what would be the best. I mean, right there, that will be of assistance. A lot of people use the 9921 codes by billing by time for transition-based activities. I believe, again, we've never done this, but we have been told that CCS, because there's complex case management, if you're looking about multiple providers, and services, you can also bill for transition-based case management and coordination. Again, it depends on your billing structure. And, you know, with like Calium coming down the pipe, for example, how we're going to be reimbursed for complex case management, and this would fall within that purview. How is that going to be billed? So that's still, I think, up in the air, at least within our hospital system. But there's a lot of ways to get reimbursed for this.
So the next question is, I think, wow, it's such a challenging challenge, but where do profoundly disabled adults go once their parent or caregiver system cannot care for them anymore? What is the usual scenario?
Yeah, so that's purely dependent on the family situation. I have transitioned persons into the group home setting. Again, if that is within the wheelhouse of what you're thinking about, I also try to do that ahead of time. I was having a conversation about that with one of the parents, and also talk about this. If you are a parent, talk about this to your siblings. I had one mother who I was caring for their child. We were going through the process of talking to other moms. I have a couple of parents who have children in group homes to talk with the mom, to think about that process. Unfortunately, she just died and didn't tell her children about it. So now her children are taking care of that patient. And so I'm now going through that process with the siblings. In terms of that person, again, they're taking care of their sister. It's just a matter of like, you know, every family has a different need and their resource. Is home healthy enough? Can we keep that person at home? Do they need a group home situation? Those are very, very individualized. But again, it's about that communication of what are the needs, long-term planning. I usually, you know, even if that patient is, you know, 25, 26, I have a blunt conversation with the parents. What happens if you die? What are your plans? I need to know that to be able to best advocate.
Thank you so much. And any final comments? I think we'll go over if we try to answer the other questions. If you can do that, maybe afterwards in the Q&A. But in the meantime, I guess the important thing is start early. You know, do the planning, start early. And then I guess the system has to make sure that we're given, you know, the right billing codes or whatever is necessary to sort of support the process. And then for maybe the two worlds, the internal medicine, adult medicine world, and the pediatric world to collaborate.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.